KFRO 102.7. Welcome to the program. We're very excited about today's program. We have two excellent interviews, some news items. We'll have some music for you. My name is Kelly, and I'm here with my co-host, Marge. And just to give you a brief outline of what you're going to be hearing today, our first interviewee is Dr. Colin Campbell, with whom we spoke a few weeks ago. And today's topic is going to be on fisheries and oceans. Dr. Campbell is a member of the Sierra Club and has some amazing experience. He was born and raised in Melbourne, Australia, trained in zoology and paleontology, and has studied in Berkeley, California, where he got his PhD, environmental law, and as well as a ton of experience in environmental groups here in British Columbia. So now with the Sierra Club, we're going to be interviewing him. And then I'm going to hand it over to Marge. And Marge, do you want to tell us a little bit about your interview today?
Yes, I do, Kelly. Her name is Leanne McConaughey, and she is the Director of Farm Animal Programs for the Vancouver Humane Society. Leanne is going to talk about how a donor should go about assessing performance of animal welfare organizations.
Fantastic. Hello. Sounds very interesting. And then we will also have some news items to get into. So do we have Dr. Colin on the line?
Not yet.
Okay. We seem to have lost him. So let's just talk a little bit about what's going on in the animal world. You had a fun little item, Marge, about some interspecies adoption, shall we say.
Yes. This is an item regarding dog adopts tiger triplets. Rather unusual combination there, I think. But a Chinese dog has become the surrogate mother of tiger triplets born at a zoo in the country's eastern Shandong province. The mongrel bitch called Huani is suckling the tiger cubs, imaginatively named 1, 2, and 3 by staff.
Wow.
At a wild animal world zoo. And the reason is their mother rejected them shortly after birth. The zoo manager said Huani is expected to nurse the tigers for about a month or until their appetites outpace her milk supply. Mr. Yakai said it was common for Chinese zoos to use dogs as surrogate mothers for rejected tiger cubs. Zoo staff have previously put dog urine on the fur of a rejected cub to make the surrogate think she is nursing her own pup. Now, I just wonder if she really thinks that.
I think the maternal instinct.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I think the maternal instinct crosses the species barrier. That's so cute.
But this is not exclusive to Chinese zoos, apparently. A spokesperson at the London Zoo said staff tries to match an abandoned animal with a mother of the same species. However, if that is not possible, then they will go to a mother of another species. They also have taken a tiger cub and had it fed by an Akita hound. This went on for 9 months, if you please. And apparently it worked very well.
I like that, if you please. Yeah, I got a picture on the email of a little dachshund who was suckling a tiny little pig. And it's very strange to see, but very wonderful. Well, we have our first interviewee on the line, Dr. Colin Campbell. So let's talk to him right now. Dr. Campbell, are you with us on the line?
I am. Hi, Kendall.
Hi, Colin. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm really looking forward to talking with you. Let's get right into it. Today, as I said to our listeners, we're going to be talking about our oceans and something so essential to the life of the planet and ourselves and all the animals and fish on which it depends, obviously. So let's just start by talking about what does the Sierra Club do for our oceans? I've heard a term used when talking about ocean. Ocean environmental causes, and they talk about integrated management. What does that mean exactly?
Well, let's start one step back. I mean, the reason that we're so concerned about oceans is, as you suggested, they're so important to us. It's like half of the oxygen in the atmosphere comes from tiny organisms in the ocean. You know, 80% of all life on Earth is found in the oceans. 99% of where life can live is in the oceans. We're in the other 1%.
Wow.
And we notice, you know, in the conservation movement that attention is easily put on land where we're familiar, but not so easily into the ocean. So the idea then is because we depend on the ocean resources so heavily that we need to integrate our management. And there's two components to integration. One is that we want to integrate human use and demands into the productivity of the oceans. You often hear people say that humans are part of the marine ecosystem. Well, they're really not.
No way.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't evolve in the marine system. And in fact, as far as I can find, the oldest archaeology, the oldest evidence of humans even eating seafood is about 150,000 years ago. Now, that might sound a lot, but it's really not in Earth history terms.
Right.
It's quite recent. So that means all of our very early ancestors did not eat from the ocean. So now we depend on them heavily. 2.5 billion humans rely on the oceans for their protein. The other piece about integration is, if you're a fisheries manager and a salmon run is declining, you might find out that, yes, climate's got a bit to do with it and ocean conditions have something to do with it, but you might find that building of golf courses and agricultural practices up in the rivers is affecting the spawning. But you have no authority over that, and that's where we need integration. We need all those people who have some kind of determinative role in what happens in the oceans to be at least in a place where they can hear each other and hopefully make decisions connected to each other.
That's so important, isn't it, that all the different groups associated with ocean conservation and as well as animal conservation work together, because many times their interests seem to butt heads, don't they?
They do. They do. And even if they don't butt heads, it's like they should they should butt heads.
Yeah.
They need to be in a place where they can, because things happen and people don't even know or think about or care about the consequences downstream from that decision.
Yeah, and speaking of the consequences downstream, what is the current situation in the oceans? How bad is the situation? Because we know it's not good, talking about the environment.
No, it's not very good.
What's the situation there?
Interesting. This February has been a very interesting month. There have been a couple of very important reports come out, one of which was the first map of the human impact on marine ecosystems. Came out in the journal Science. It's got quite a lot of detail, but simply put, at least 50% of the ocean is strongly affected by multiple impacts coming from our activities.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only 4% that you could even pretend you could call pristine. And most of that is still under the ice. It's where we can't get at it, basically.
But they're doing their best to get at it, aren't they?
Well, that's right. And, but you know, here's the hard message. There's a few places. There's an atoll north of Hawaii called Palmyra, which is closed to all human activity. A few researchers live there and watch it. Everything there is working fine. Lots of big fish, healthy coral, all of that. And the only difference between that and a reef 1,000 miles away is the way humans utilize it. So in the end, you know, this is to go back to integrated management. There's been a lot of resistance to integrated management. And I believe that the reason is that the first sensible thing you do when you integrate your management is you stop. You back off.
Yeah, and you know, people do not like to be told that, do they?
Well,
you can't fish,
you
can't golf, you can't eat so much salmon.
It sort of defies our economic thinking, you know, that we have to keep growing, and that's problematic. That's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let's
sure.
Go ahead. I was just gonna ask about, you mentioned Hawaii sort of as an untouched area of the world. Are there any areas besides Antarctica and areas under the ice that aren't touched? Like, are there areas of the ocean that are, let's say, too deep that we can't fish, where the fish can be safe and reproduce? Are there any places that the fish and mammals are safe in the ocean from human consumption?
No place, well, that's a good question, because there's no place we can't get to. The technology of trawling the bottom and so on is now so sophisticated it really doesn't matter. And we have the kind of sensory technology like sonars and stuff to actually see the fish. So nobody's dropping bait and hoping a fish will show up. They know where the fish are.
Yeah.
But the other part of the question is, yes, there are a few places, but less than 1%. Like, if you look at protected areas on the surface of the Earth terrestrially, you might get 8, 10, 12, 14% in various countries, but you never get more than 1% of marine protected areas.
That is crazy, because I think of the oceans as being so much larger than the Earth and just so much more free, like the fish have freedom, they can get away from us, but apparently not.
And you know, the protected areas in the oceans really work well, because life is so profuse and abundant that they literally become fish machines, you know, they produce more fish than can live there. mm-hmm. and they move out and they become a source of good fishing. But I can tell you that Daniel Pauly out at the University of British Columbia and his team out there are starting to say, look, you know, if we're going to pull through this, we need to set aside about 20% of the oceans and just, like, close them down.
Yeah.
And economically, you're looking at a hit on fishing of somewhere between 1% and 7% to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're looking at is a future for fishing. That's the trade-off. Seems fair to me.
I know. It's called deferred gratification. We humans seem to be very bad at it.
That's right. That's
and speaking right. of our local industries, I know that so many of the challenges with the oceans involve, you know, international conflict and that kind of thing. But here in BC, we hear a lot about our salmon fishing industry. And the salmon fish, and I know that I've seen headlines that wild salmon stocks will be depleted in 4 years, which frightens me a lot, especially as people are saying, don't eat farmed salmon. So let's just talk about I know a bit about the salmon farming industry, which seems to be the main one here in BC. But how are fish farms endangering wild salmon stocks?
Well, there's several issues there, and it's an interesting topic. And let's start at the top and say that, as a general proposition, farming of fish is inevitable, and mm-hmm. we need to do it because we simply can't extract the level of fish protein out of the oceans that we have done in the past.
Right.
You know, these are wild animals. This is the last great hunt, and we're overfishing them. You know, so as a general proposition, yes, we need to farm fish. But if you're going to do that, what would be smart? Well, you would probably nobody raises tigers for steaks, you know? It's like carnivores, top carnivores, use up so much protein. Like, to raise a pound of fish, kilo of fish, you need about 3 kilos of food taken from the ocean, which is other fish, little ones, that would be better off in there. So there's that part of it. There's that food chain implication of raising salmon.
Yeah, we forget. So salmon are carnivores. They eat other fish.
They eat other fish. You know, if you go and buy tilapia in your fish market that's grown, you know, you can even grow it organically in freshwater ponds, you're way down the food chain, and it's far less damaging to the oceans or any other system. But let's just talk about lice for a minute, because it's there was an important study done up in the Broughton Archipelago just north of Vancouver Island that showed that spring salmon were seriously endangered because spring salmon are a little bit different from others. Pink salmon.
Mm-hmm.
They have a 2-year life cycle. They come out of the rivers very small, very young. And all of the pathways where they swim out to the ocean are now sort of blocked, or not barricaded, but they're flanked by fish farms because there's good current movement and all that sort of stuff.
And the current movement cleans out the waste from the fish farms? Is that the idea?
Well, there is that idea. It's also convenient. You can get to them. But mm-hmm. what happens is, of course, these lice, which are always present on wild salmon, get concentrated on the salmon in the nets. And there's always a cloud of them around the fish farms. And when the small pinks set off on their ocean journey, they get these lice pick up on them. And it only takes 2 or 3. They're a little ectoparasite. They're related to crayfish, of all things. They're crustaceans, little tiny ones. And they just sort of eat body fluids through the skin, and they're a hard parasite to resist when you're a tiny fish.
Oh, I see.
A few of them on an adult fish is no big deal.
Right.
But the thing about them becoming extinct is not total extinction. It's extinction of those runs that pass through the area of the salmon farms. And not in 4 years, but in 4 generations. So they have a 2-year generation. So in 8 to 10 years, without doing something about these infestations, we're very likely to see local loss of pink salmon. And pink salmon, by the way, are the most abundant salmon on the West Coast.
Hmm. Yeah. So, oh my gosh, is it true that we should avoid farmed salmon then at all costs? Because then you hear, oh, yes, but then you're depleting the BC fishing industry, and, you know, 80% of our fish get sent to the States, and we'll never survive the, you know, our industry will never survive the kind of environmental demands that environmental groups are making on them.
Look, that's the hardest possible question. Hardly anybody depends on salmon for their protein. Like, it's not part of the world food equation. It's mostly a luxury food.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why farms do so well is because they can deliver it at a fixed price every day of the year, whereas the wild fishery is seasonal.
Right.
They can grow high volumes of it. question is there a way to do it which doesn't cause damage? And yes, you could place them in better situations so that the infestation of the wild salmon didn't happen.
That would be a start.
Well, yeah, there are other locations you can that wouldn't be necessarily as convenient. The next level of containment is to actually contain them so that they're not in the ocean. They're in tanks on shore with seawater being filtered and pumped through them. And, of course, the industry says this is not cost-effective.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is to really think about it again. And at some point, we really probably as a society should think about backing off from this highly expensive luxury food where, because we are, we go to the southern hemisphere and net out tiny fish from, you know, the oceans and turn it into fish oil and fish meal. And
mm-hmm.
it's true that most of it gets fed to pigs and chickens, but it still gets fed to salmon also. And it's not a wise practice.
So interesting. I had no idea that we took fish food from the oceans to feed to salmon. Holy.
Yeah.
Speaking also about the oceans, thank you so much for that information about our salmon industry. Thinking about the oceans, what about whales? I remember in the 80s hearing a lot about save the whales, and I'm not sure if that was just, you know, a Greenpeace campaign that got a lot of publicity, but how are the whales doing? I'm assuming they're still in danger, and their situation can't have improved in the past 20 years.
Yeah, this is not a big area of expertise for me, but for mm-hmm. instance, whaling on this coast stopped somewhere back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so gray whales at that point were down to about 4,000, and we know they're up to about 25,000 now. So
there's
good recovery with the gray whales. They're the ones that come down our coast every year and go to the big lagoons in Baja California for breeding, you know, and
yes.
people can actually get quite close to them.
Yeah.
Now, but interestingly, and this is an interesting point, some years ago, about the year 2000, about a quarter of that population died in 1 year, like 25% of them, some thousands of whales. Nobody really knows why. It had something to do with their food supply. Whales are at the top of the food chain. Even if they only eat plankton,
mm-hmm.
they need massive amounts of it. And if the oceans aren't as productive as they have been, then whales will be indicators of that. Some other whales just simply haven't been seen. Since whaling ended, they haven't come back. The sei whales and the fin whales were last seen here, and even the right whales, which are all in quite small numbers. But, for instance, last year, 5 blue whales, the biggest thing that's ever lived, gigantic animals,
mm-hmm.
Probably a couple of thousand of them still alive, 5 of them were seen in BC waters, and it gave some hope that, oh, maybe they're going to come back. So the recovery for these is slow, but our iconic whale is the killer whale, which is really a big dolphin. And we have, where we live, the Southern Resident Group, which is about 90 members in 3 different groups. They call them pods.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their population is declining gradually. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we know that they're salmon feeders, so they're susceptible to the level of salmon. They also have quite a lot of toxics in their body from the industrial practices in our area. And they get harassed to a certain extent, even by tourists and surface vessels. And there's also a lot of noise. So these are the things that are impacts on the whales. But killer whales are all around the world. And there's a northern resident group here, 2 up in northern BC, which is larger. There's about 250 of those.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've seen those off the BC ferries. It's quite exciting.
Yeah, that's right. And they're a marvelous animal. You know, like the ones that hunt in pods for salmon are very vocal and very organized.
Yeah.
But the ones they call transients that hang around up north, they tend to be alone. They come together and they hunt seals and dolphins.
Hmm.
It's quite different. And they have to be quiet because those animals can hear them coming. So they have a completely different behavioral regime. And there seem to be a group that live in the off ocean. They call them the offshore orcas. And they're probably the ancestral group to these ones that work these specialized jobs inshore. So we know a lot about them, but the people who know a lot keep telling us we only know a little.
Yeah.
They're hard to get at, you know.
Well, that makes me really sad that some of those populations haven't been found since whaling stopped. It would be such a loss. We need to take care of those large mammals, and it would be a huge accomplishment if we can have them survive all this environmental craziness that we're getting through as a globe.
They have, you know, they live a long time, and, you know, like a female orca will maybe have 4 offspring in her life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're very susceptible to, very slow to recover when their numbers are knocked down.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and the last thing I wanted to talk about relates, I guess, again, to environments. I read recently about a huge pile of garbage floating in the ocean north of Hawaii, and it's this, the ocean currents have brought together, you know, hundreds and, well, basically thousands of square miles of garbage, mostly plastic, floating on the ocean or floating just below the surface of the ocean. And I was quite horrified to read that and see in a diagram how large it is. And I read that marine birds eat this plastic thinking it's fish, feed it to their young, and you know, the young die, and when the researchers do an autopsy, their stomach is full of this plastic. So essentially, this pollution is really hurting the bird populations around the ocean. And it's I just wondered if you knew anything about that and what your take on it was.
Well, I do know about that, and I mean, what you're seeing there is material being trapped in the natural circulation patterns of the ocean. But I mean, really, what that's about is about plastics, and plastics are. Plastics don't break down. They don't break down. They don't. Well, let me be technical here. They don't decompose. They're always plastic, but they break down into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. They get worn away. You know, the sunlight will break them down a little bit, and friction and time. And not only do birds eat pieces of it and mistaking it for jellyfish and stuff like that, but it gets down to micron-sized particles in the water, the same size as plankton. So little tiny animal plankton eat these things thinking they're plant plankton, or they filter them out of the water.
Oh, wow.
And so there's some, in some cases, 30 or 40% of their food is actually not nutrition. It's this stuff which can't digest them. So there's a very serious problem with plastics, and it's one of those things that we could probably address quite quickly. You see various jurisdictions saying no more plastic shopping bags.
Mm-hmm.
Plastics can largely be recycled. And they're, you know, when you think about where they come from oil. And oil is another whole story. Which,
that's right,
you know,
which we've spoken
about
before.
Someday, you know, the remains of life. You know,
right.
But it seems to me terribly wasteful to let that happen. And I think it's one of those things that anybody who wanted to campaign locally and know that they're doing good for the living world, take on plastics. They're a monstrous problem.
Well, that's good to hear. Well, thank you so much, Colin. I'm going to I have so many questions. I could talk with you forever, but we're going to wrap up this interview. And thank you so much for your time. And are there any last words you'd like to say about this topic or the Sierra Club?
Well, just in general, you know, first of all, I hope I'm not too depressing for your audiences, because
no,
there is
don't
a lot
worry.
Of tough news out there about our environment. But there's also a lot of good happening. People are coming together in an amazing way. The Sierra Club or any other of the environmental organizations that appeals to you, do some web cruising, find someone you like, support them, volunteer, work with us.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think taking action alleviates some of the depression and the overwhelm from hearing this kind of information.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much again. That was Colin Campbell from the Sierra Club, based in Victoria, and definitely an expert on the oceans and the environment. So thank you again, Colin. And we're going to have a little bit of music right now before we lead into our second interview. You're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM.
Our next guest is on the line now, and I'll just tell you a little bit about her before we start our interview. With us is Leanne McConaughey, who is Director of Farm Animal Programs for the Vancouver Humane Society. Leanne is a graduate of UBC's program in animal welfare. And for her master's thesis, she researched how donors should go about assessing performance of animal welfare organizations in order to ensure that donor funds are directed toward the most efficient organizations. Well, that sounds like an interesting topic for sure. Now, welcome to Animal Voices, Leanne.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps you could start by telling us why assessing performance is so important. I know a lot of donors would probably like to donate to whatever cause is closest to their hearts.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And of course, it always starts there, what matters most to us. But you know, given that such a small percentage of total charitable donations go towards organizations helping animals in the first place, I believe it's just over 1% actually of all charitable donations go to animal causes, it's really crucial that donors to these animal groups do some basic research on the organization to ensure that it is in fact doing what it says it's doing and that it actually has the ability to accomplish those goals in the future as well. Mm-hmm. You know, all too often we, you know, react to a sad image in an ad or a commercial or something that pulls at our heartstrings, or even a really great-sounding mission statement that seems to resonate with our own beliefs, but then when we don't look into the background or performance of that organization to see if, in fact, they have been effective in the past or actually do what they say they're doing, we're really not doing a great service to the animal groups that are out there that are making headway with progress and, you know, make sure our money goes to the right groups that can really get things done.
So what kind of performance? Perhaps we could pin that down a bit. Now, would this be how many animals they save or how many newsletters they circulate, how many events they hold? How is one to judge the performance?
Yeah, and actually very often as donors, we often hear about the things that are easy to track, and that's partially because it's something that we can understand, but also it's what animal groups will put out there for us to hear because it's easy to look at, you know, how many animals did we take in or how many newsletters did we circulate, how many events did we hold. But these are really what I would refer to as, and what many in the nonprofit sector refer to as inputs and outputs. They're not really outcomes, which outcomes relate to performance. So if we kind of look at the easier part of the question, you know, the number of newsletters and events, well, these are what an organization will put out in order to achieve an outcome. For example, did the majority of those who read the newsletter or attended the event, did they sign a petition perhaps that affected some sort of change, maybe a change in regulations or legislation? Or did the event bring some media attention that actually helped to free an animal from a bad situation or close an event that exploited animals, say like a rodeo or something? So, you know, those kind of events we want to look at, you know, not just how many did they have, but what did they actually achieve as a result of that event. Mm-hmm. As for the other part, the animals saved, it gets a little tricky there because, you know, we really want to wonder, what do we mean by saved? You know, are we just quoting how many animals that an organization took in, which is an input, actually, not an outcome? Really, what happened to those animals? You know, in the case of a shelter, you might ask, were they rehomed? In the case of a wildlife center, were they rehabilitated or returned to the wild? You know, what percentage of those animals had to be euthanized? And, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole euthanasia debate today unless there's time, but it's really one of those issues that, you know, sure, we would love to have a world where there was zero euthanasia, but given that, you know, people still want to buy puppies, there's still too many animals being bred, there's not enough homes that want pets, the rental agreement still doesn't allow landlords to turn, or does allow landlords to turn away renters with animals, you know, getting to zero euthanasia is impossible, but what we do want to see is, are those euthanasia rates decreasing? So in terms of animals saved, are the majority of animals getting readopted or rehomed? And is there fewer animals being euthanized? And that's really perhaps an outcome that we want to see, that over time those rates are improving. If the rates are staying the same or getting worse, then you might want to consider another organization with a better track record.
Yes, and how do you get this information? Do you simply go phone up and ask the organization their mm-hmm. outcomes? And I wonder if that would get at the truth of the matter.
Most organizations, if it's a good organization, they will keep track of this information. I mean, some will still use the old pen and paper way and keep track of it in a book somewhere. Mm-hmm. But some of the more sophisticated groups actually have software systems that allow them to track this information, because if they're good, they want to know for themselves, are they making headway? So they're going to be keeping track, looking at their results, because they want to be able to go out to their donors and say, this is what we've achieved over the last year, and this is where we're heading. So if a group can't produce that information for you, again, that's something you really kind of want to look at as a red flag and question why they can't provide that data. It is absolutely something they should be tracking.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the most important aspects of an animal charity for donors to assess?
Well, because these outcomes are sometimes difficult to demonstrate or even understand for some people, or you know, in some cases they're actually really long-term goals and so difficult to assess today, as part of my thesis, I actually developed a tool to help donors assess some basic criteria of any organization. And I call this tool the PREP framework, and that's P-R-E-P. So PREP, P for philosophy, R for red flags, E for efficiency, and P for people. And of those four, I suppose the easiest to research and maybe the most critical are the two P's, the philosophy and the people. And when I talk about philosophy, it's one thing to look at a mission statement, but a really critical item that donors should look to are position statements. You know, you want to look at how do they feel about certain things around, you know, are they keeping wildlife, or are they protecting wildlife habitat simply for hunting later on, or are they protecting it for the animal's sake so they have wild spaces to roam and be free? When it comes to the whole companion shelter, I mean, what is their policy, what is their philosophy around, you know, numbers of animals they take in? Do they set a limit so that there's not overcrowding? Those sorts of things. So it's really important to look at those position statements for sure. And then under people, you know, obviously you want to look at the management team. What backgrounds do they have to enable them to do the job? And you'd assess that really like, you know, any company where you wanted to go work for them or invest in their stock. You look at the management. Do they have the background, the education, the skills to handle the job? But also, one of the key aspects that was pointed out during my research from the participants that were in my study was that what kind of relationship does this organization have with its peers? You know, do they have effective working relationships with other animal groups? Do they have the support of recognized scientists? And if not, you kind of have to question sometimes the validity of the group or the intent of the group. So those peer relationships, you know, I'm not saying they have to have a relationship with every group that's out there, but certainly, you know, there should be some situations where you see them working together on an issue where maybe one group is supporting the other group or helping them with a cause, giving them information even if that's it, or bringing in experts to work on projects with them.
Hmm. Yeah, because you certainly don't want to have a divisive group, do you, in animal welfare that's undermining anybody else?
Absolutely. It's one of the important, probably one of the most important aspects. You know, our cause, we're making some great headway these days with some of the initiatives, especially that have come out of the States and in Canada as well. But we need to work together for the movement, you know, for the humane movement as a whole. We need to kind of get along. And by having this sort of bantering back and forth, it really just weakens the movement as a whole. I'm not saying everyone has to agree with the other's tactics, but there is a role for every group, from the very radical to the moderate. And as a movement, we need to recognize that and not bash the other guys down in public. I mean, certainly behind the scenes, we can probably have our differences and discuss those in private. But, you know, in terms of what we present to the public, we all need to sort of be there on behalf of the animals and fulfill the role that each of us can do and that we're sort of designated to do. And really make note of the good things that our peers are doing and not focus on the bad. I mean, the enemy is, we're not each other. We're all here to help the animals, all of us in a slightly different way. But I think what it does is it confuses donors and ultimately takes more money away from our cause. So, you know, what I like to say to donors who fall into the trap of saying, well, so-and-so says those guys aren't any good, support a group for what they do for animals. Don't withhold the support because of what they don't do.
Mm, good advice. Mm-hmm. Now, the PREP model it also refers to efficiency. Now, I'm wondering, does that mean that how they use the finances, like low administration costs and low salaries for management, are those good indicators?
They are certainly aspects to look at, because you certainly don't want to see things go completely disproportionate to the budget. But again, these are stats that we've often used in the past because they're easy to find, and quite honestly, there's been charities that have abused this, and so donors have a genuine mistrust sometimes. But they're really not a good indicator of performance for a couple of reasons. Revenue Canada, for one, they don't really define what administration is to charity. So it's really whatever the charity more or less says it is, and there's ways, you know, of orchestrating that information to make it fit the government requirements. But the other factor is that too low of a administration cost, that's not good either. It means that the organization is probably operating below its resource requirements, or perhaps they've got inadequate skills that they've had to hire at very low salaries and not getting the people with the right skill set for the job, or maybe it's all volunteer, which is can be a very unstable situation with, you know, volunteers that have other jobs, and so this is just something they do in their spare time. You know, I always think, to again, if we sort of put this akin to the private sector, if this was a company that we were investing in and the company was achieving all of its objectives, we wouldn't question how much the CEO got paid or how they spent shareholders' money. We would just say, hey, you know, you guys have demonstrated you know best, so go and do it. And it's only if they aren't achieving that we would maybe start to question those finances and who's the management and what are they paid. So what we really want to do is focus on the objectives and performance, the achievement of those objectives when assessing a charity. Mm-hmm. And if they, you know, get legislation passed or they prevent an exploitive event from continuing or rehome the vast majority of animals they take in, then I don't think we should really question how that money was spent. I think we can feel comfortable knowing that they're getting the job done in the best way that they know how.
So we shouldn't put too much emphasis on the financial statement, in other words.
Huh? Yeah, not too much. Certainly look at it, and if things are out of line, ask them questions. I mean, there might be very good reasons. There might have been a catastrophe, and they've had to rebuild a shelter, and so there's a lot of money going into operation costs or something like that. But by and large, take a look at those things if you have time. But first and foremost, look to see, are they achieving the objectives that they said they were going to achieve? Is the philosophy aligned with what I believe in? And are they slowly making progress towards the end goal?
Mm-hmm. And now let's assume that I, as a donor, have narrowed my list down to 5 organizations that I believe are quite effective. Now, should I give the whole sum? Say this is quite a large sum of money I'm giving. or should I give it all to one charity?
Yeah, it's a very common question that I hear a lot. I think we all go through that thinking, should I give, you know, 100 each or 500 to one? How am I going to make the most difference? And sometimes there are certainly cases where there's a specific issue that needs addressing and you want to put it all in one place. But what I look at is trying to give across the spectrum. You know, no one group can do everything, and that's where this idea, too, of peer relationships comes in, is that you want to support organizations that address the root cause, but also those that have to service the status quo. You may also want to support those who are a little more radical for pushing the movement forward and getting attention, or maybe even doing the things that others can't or won't do. But, at the same time, there's others that have to do the moderate actions and take care of the day-to-day business. So kind of look at a few areas, and even groups that aren't registered charities. I mean, most of us, when we donate, we look for that charitable status as a sign of some sort of trust. But, you know, there are a lot of things that charities can't do. Example in Canada, certainly, is lobbying government for legislative change. So as a charity, our hands are tied by Revenue Canada on political activity. So maybe teaming up or not teaming up, but maybe donating with a lobby group that's able to do those roles, a non-profit group, obviously, but one that's not charitable status, that would be a good place to maybe help to really get that fundamental change. And finally, another area that people may even want to consider is, you know, donating to groups outside of Canada. In the U.S., for example, lobbying rules are quite different. The Humane Society of the United States has been able to make some really fundamental legislative change recently through their lobbying and ballot initiatives. And that progress, it just simply filters up here. So as a Canadian donor, you may not get a tax receipt, but you would get a result or an outcome. So mm-hmm. The idea really being that when you look at organizations, look at all the inputs and outputs that have to go into achieving a desired outcome, and then support the most effective groups that each contribute in their own way towards achieving that outcome.
Now, you mentioned lobbying, and I know that charitable groups are not to be lobbyists, but did you say something about a group aligning itself with a lobbying, non-charity lobbying group?
Not so much aligning, like a group aligning, but more as a donor. If you look at, for example, I believe IFAW is one that's in Canada, certainly, International Fund for Animal Welfare. And they are a nonprofit group, but they don't have charitable status because they do have meetings with their federally elected officials. They do lobby for legislative change on the Animal Cruelty Act, those sorts of things. But I can donate to them, but I would not get a charitable receipt or tax receipt. So, you know, they're in Ottawa. They're there on the ground. They're meeting with people. They're pushing for all the things that the other groups are asking for. They're just able to do a little bit more of it. So if I feel that, you know, supporting my local group, you know, what would really help them in the mission that they're trying to achieve is maybe helping this other group as well in Ottawa to really push the envelope. Maybe I should put a little bit of funding there too. So, mm-hmm. as I say, it's kind of taking a look at the whole gamut and realizing what is it that you as a donor are hoping your funds will achieve. And then looking at the groups that, you know, whether they may work together already. You might see some, you know, some things in some press releases where both groups have been working on an issue together. And say, well, you know what, between those five groups or those three groups, they've all been able together achieve this goal, and so it makes sense for me to keep funding the three of them or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm, I see.
That kind of an idea, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does one decide between allocating a large amount of funds to save an individual animal's life versus applying that money to help multiple animals? Let me give you an example. Maybe a dog is being hit by a car, so that you have $2,000 to donate, so you give it to saving that one animal, as opposed to donating it to a group that's spaying and neutering dogs and cats, and they could do a whole lot more for mm-hmm. many animals as opposed to one. Now, could you address that question?
Yeah, and it's another one that's often... the question often comes up from donors and even from people in animal welfare groups as well. It's like, you know, do we apply money to the greater good where, you know, we could take this money to help a whole bunch of animals through some sort of advocacy campaign, or do we put it towards this one? And certainly for us as individual donors, I mean, individual animals, they have a name, they have a face. Being able to give to an animal's care is something certainly very tangible, and so it really appeals to us as donors. You know, we feel comfortable knowing that our money went directly to the animal and not a person. So I would say certainly do support an abused or injured animal if it's important to you. But also remember that it's important to continue looking at addressing root causes. It's the changes in all the other aspects that help it so that these animals won't be in the position of needing this type of help in the future. Now, certainly with an animal that's been hit by a car, that's not a case of abuse, it's an accident, but, you know, perhaps there's a situation where that's not an animal has been purchased or adopted out to family without a fence, and so the animal runs out on the road. So maybe there should be some guidelines in adoption processes to make sure there are fenced areas, and I know many of the rescue groups do require that. But, you know, if we always feel that we have to give to the animal's care and not to other things, and again, this is where people's aversion to giving to salaries and operating costs comes in, uh-huh. remember that the animals can't speak for themselves, and they need us humans to do that for them. And that's where donors have to appreciate that they have to pay for operating costs and salaries of those individuals who are willing to step up and speak on behalf of the animals. So again, certainly give to the one animal that somehow, for some reason, that particular animal helping that one is calling to you, but also remember to reserve a little bit for the other factors of the equation that need addressing too.
Yeah, the broader issues mm-hmm. that are so important.
Yeah.
And maybe not quite so satisfying either when you don't see the immediate outcome as you would with helping an injured animal.
Definitely, yeah, because we all like, part of giving is that feedback, that emotional mm-hmm. feedback that we get of feeling that we've done something good. And when we kind of can attach to something that we know where it went, we can feel that a little bit more. And it's a bit of a selfish thing for ourselves, but
exactly.
Totally understandable.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, just giving money to a group that you know they're doing good things with that money, rest assured that that is helping animals everywhere, and not get too caught up. Donors shouldn't get too caught up in knowing exactly where it went. Let the good organizations mm-hmm. figure it out. And again, I stress the good ones because there are certainly ones that, you know, aren't going to be as effective with those funds. And that's where, as I say, the onus is on us as donors to really be sure that we're placing it in the best possible place where it can be the most effective and do the greatest good.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot of information, Leanne. I'm going to ask you a rather impossible question, but maybe just in winding up, you could summarize the key points that you've made today for people who are wanting to give money to animal welfare groups.
Sure. So first and foremost, decide what it is that is important to you. Pick the cause, whether it's farm animals, maybe it's companion animals, perhaps it's wildlife rehabilitation, those sorts of things. So decide, and it might be all of those things, and again, that's where you might want to give to different types of groups rather than the same group in different areas, the same type of group. So pick what matters to you most. Then start by first researching under the PREP framework, the philosophy. So ask the organizations, maybe you've found five groups that all do, let's just pick something different than companion animals for a sec, wildlife rehabilitation. Find those five. And then ask them for what their mission and objectives are. So this is under the philosophy, you know, preventing the root cause. Do they meet a community need? What are their positions and policy statements? Then sort of do a quick scan, perhaps, at some of the red flags. You know, do they have excessive personnel turnover? Do they have disproportionate management salaries? Do they have a lack of peer collaboration? You know, and then look to some of the efficiency aspects. You know, do they have a strategic plan? Do their objectives actually align with their budget? Do they adhere to their budget? And do they have financial reserves in place to withstand any kind of economic downturns or sudden catastrophes? And finally, the fourth of the PREP framework is people. Look at the management team. Do they have the experience and training you think is needed to do that job? Do they pay their people well so that, you know, they're not going to have constant churn in their staff and management team? Do they have adequate involvement of volunteers? And do they have, again, good working relationships with peers, collaborative partnerships? Can they get great references from other groups? So pick your cause, do a little bit of homework, and then decide of the groups that you've looked at, which ones do you believe are going to most align with your own personal philosophy and which are going to be the best groups to achieve those goals.
Very well done, Leanne. Thank you so much for being on Animal Voices today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, we certainly appreciate it.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM, and we're going to have a little bit of music coming up, and then we have some fantastic new news items to wrap up our show. You're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM. I have a few news items, things happening in the world. The first, on a kind of a positive note, we'll talk about tofurkey, one of the most popular meat alternatives on the market, a company with a very fun name and a very well-known brand name. I know that I just saw the movie 27 Dresses, and they talk about tofurkey as the ultimate vegetarian cuisine. Tofurkey has teamed up with Humane Society of the United States, HSUS, so that all their products will now be labeled with the HSUS symbol. So I like hearing about this kind of thing because consumers are often baffled by all the things in the market. So having an HSUS symbol will really help guide people to some meat alternatives. If we could just cut down on meat consumption, one meatless meal a week would make a huge difference if everybody did that. One important goal, this is a quote from the senior director of the Humane Society of the U.S. One important goal of the HSUS is to encourage market solutions that benefit animals. So it's a privilege to share the stage with a company producing a healthy and animal-friendly product. That's a quote from Paul Shapiro, senior director of the HSUS factory farming campaign. And the article also reminds us of some a few facts about factory farming. Each year, U.S. factory farms raise and kill more than 9 billion farm animals. They often endure lives filled with suffering and are generally unprotected from even the worst slaughter abuses. Factory farms also pollute our environment, and raising animals for food contributes to global warming at least as much as automobiles. So definitely something for those of us who are concerned about the environment to make changes in our personal diet. In its effort to combat the worst factory farm abuses, the HSUS encourages the three R's. We love our R's in environmental and animal rights. The three R's are refine the methods of animal production to eliminate the most inhumane practices, reduce the consumption of animal products, and replace animal products with meat-free alternatives. So that's refine, reduce, and replace. So that's in the Tofurky and HSUS news. And in another item on the other side of the world, we hear a lot about animal endangered species. And here is there's actually an opposite problem in Africa, in southern Africa. Specifically, South Africa has been hugely successful in managing its elephant population, which was once on the verge of extinction. But it's now become a victim of its own success, and herds are growing at a rate of more than 5% a year. And they are expected to double by 2020. Now, it doesn't take much to realize that a doubling the population of elephants will have a huge impact on the very delicate environment of Africa. South Africa has about 18,000 elephants, and Southern Africa altogether is home to about 300,000 elephants. Now, there's no consensus on how to manage the elephant population, but what they've started doing is culling. Now, culling is, you know, rounding them up and basically selectively exterminating, shooting animals when there are too many of them. And there's been huge international outrage about culling. Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Botswana, which alone has the highest population of elephants. There are 165,000 elephants in Botswana, so over half the elephants in that area. They all used to cull before international outrage forced an end to the scene of game rangers rounding up trumpeting frightened herds and shooting the elephants. And this is a scene that might be resumed. It is resuming right now in South Africa. And what the South Africans are also trying to do is to get the they're saving the ivory and trying to allow them to trade it. Some scientists have arguing that culling is a crude method of solving this problem, and it results from poor wildlife management, which is what they really need to look at. So that's in international news, and we'll have one more quick item, and then we'll wrap up the show.
Yeah, we've got a couple of minutes. It's actually 5:21 right now by the Co-op radio clock. On Wednesday in the Vancouver Metro newspaper, there was an interesting little article. A breeder fined for cruelty. A BC breeder has been fined $4,000 and prohibited from owning animals for 10 years after being convicted on two counts of animal cruelty. In 2004, SPCA officers seized 47 English Mastiffs, five cats, and a pug from William Pieper of Barriere. SPCA officers said the housing conditions were filthy and the animals had untreated injuries and medical conditions. The judge called the conditions in which the animals were kept deplorable and issued the maximum fine available, said SPCA General Secretary Manager Marcy Moriarty.
Always good news to hear about the maximum fines, isn't it?
Yeah, right, yeah.
I like hearing that. That's good news to end
good
our
stuff,
show.
Good stuff, yeah. So we have a minute or two left. Did you have a short item, Marge?
I just want to ask you about Moriarty. I certainly recognize that name. And
yeah.
This was in British Columbia, was
it? Yes. We've had Marcy as a guest on this program before, but yes, she's connected to the BC SPCA, I believe, because we've had her down as a guest here.
Well, thank you for listening to Animal Voices. Next week we have lined up so far an interview with a woman at the Vancouver Zoo. We're going to find out about the education programs and the conservation efforts of the Vancouver Zoo and the important work that they do there for the animals that we all love and support so much. So my name is Kelly, and I'm here with Marge, and we're your co-hosts for Animal Voices. And tune in next week at noon on Friday, and we'll have another exciting show for you. And thank you for listening to Co-op Radio 102.7 CFRO.